The Bristol Cable is out now. Look out for one of 10,000 free copies across the city. There's investigations, local voices, debates and infographics. The Bristol Cable is local media worth reading. And you can own part of it for as little as £1 a month. And you get a direct say, free training and discounts in local businesses. So if you're fed up with mainstream media, why not read, create or own something different? The Bristol Cable, a refreshing look at the news. Pick up a copy today or visit the Bristol Cable.
BCFM. Through the use of intellect, man will conquer the earth, will conquer nature, and will himself become God. It's taught in every Masonic temple in this land, every secret brotherhood, every secret society, every mystical temple, every occult organization teaches the Luciferian philosophy.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Lake Broxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Trump may well be popular, but will the US Army and the Air Force do what he tells them? The 1933 transfer agreement between the Zionist movement and Hitler, which ended the Jewish boycott on the Nazi regime. We look at Edwin Black's book on this little-known but very dodgy deal. Also, predictive programming, psychological warfare at Hollywood. Is it possible to read Hollywood films to see where the next false flag terrorist attack is going to come from? I did an interview earlier this week with Jay Dyer from jaysanalysis.com. Plus, Martin Summers is going to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. We're going to start where we heard on the news there, Martin, is things seem to be hotting up a little bit in Northern Ireland. We've had only remaining suspect in the Omar bombing case collapsing this week.
Yeah, well, I think what happens is that gradually things, the truth comes out in dribs and drabs. And so, for example, we've discussed this on this show previously, the bombing of Frizzle's Fish Bar by the Provisional IRA was actually...
This is the Shankill Road bombing.
The Shankill Road bombing of Frizzle's Fish Bar. The target was the UDA supposedly meeting upstairs in the fish bar. The plan was that the two IRA operatives would walk into the fish bar. At gunpoint, they would then order everybody out, plant the bomb, get out of there and blow the bomb up, killing the UDA who were meeting upstairs. But what has now come to light is that the Provisional IRA commander of that unit was in fact working for the British, and he did two things. He jarked the bomb, to use the technical phrase. In other words, he made it go off when the boy was carrying the bomb into the shop was carrying it, so it went off prematurely, killing the bomber and the people in the fish shop. And the other thing is that they tipped the UDA off so that they weren't actually in the meeting. Now, in other words, what's been going on, as we discussed in the last hour, is that the Western Intelligence Services, in this case MI5, MI6, the British Army Force Research Unit run by Brigadier Gordon Kerr, were infiltrating all of the terrorist groups and manipulating them all, the Provisional IRA, the Loyalists, etc. And in other words, they actually are what Nuala O'Lone, the police ombudswoman in Northern Ireland, is saying, and she said it on Panorama a few months ago, we've got evidence now that hundreds of murders in Northern Ireland were facilitated by the British Army's Force Research Unit. So it wasn't just the IRA killing people, they were actually pulling the strings, okay, both for the IRA and the Loyalists.
We'll talk about Omar in a minute, but what we've heard today is that the IRA-style booby-trap bomb has wounded a prison officer in Belfast, and it's this is Associated Press saying Irish Republican Army diehards tried to kill a Belfast prison officer with an undercar booby-trap bomb and are plotting to kill Northern Ireland security forces in the 100th anniversary of the Irish rebellion against British rule approaches. And that's what a police commander has warned today.
Well, I'd need to
the
look at...
The commander is
I'd
Stephen...
I'd need to look at this.
He's Stephen Martin, he's assistant chief constable.
I'd need to look at this, because is the claim that provisional IRA activists did this or something like the continuity IRA? I would suggest it's more likely to be the continuity IRA than the provisional IRA.
But also, I mean, I find it very, very surprising that a senior police officer, as this has happened, has already done enough of an investigation to know who put this bomb there.
Well, that's because they've infiltrated all the groups. Now, you could argue that you infiltrate these groups to find out what they're doing. Yes, you do. But then, of course, you may be able to manipulate those groups. So in Italy, we talked about this earlier, the Brigata Rossa, the Red Brigades, were infiltrated by Sismi, and they were then directing the Red Brigades, for example, to kidnap Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister, to prevent him bringing the communists into the government.
Apparently this bomb fell off the bottom of the vehicle and blew up as it drove over a speed bump.
Well, I would suggest that that shows that the continuity IRA have not the skills of the provisional IRA. They are basically amateurs with a grudge and with no popular support. They haven't got a single elected councillor in the whole of the
state. But I suppose my point here is, if you take what you were saying earlier, that there has been, certainly in the past, a quite sizeable involvement of the British Army and the British Security Services in fomenting terrorism in Northern Ireland, that there's no reason to suggest that this might not be something similar. Is there any actual motive to kick off the troubles again?
Well, there might be if you're a securocrat and your job depends upon having security issues to deal with. I don't think we can jump to conclusions about this either way.
Well, this is why I point out, why is Stephen Martin, Assistant Chief Constable of the Northern Ireland Police, jumping to conclusions here? Does he already know who's done
it? I think it's fairly reasonable to suggest that the most likely perpetrators of this are dissident Republican groups.
Yeah, well, in which case, that's what he should say.
That's a working hypothesis. Could be that those groups are infiltrated by MI5 or MI6 or the equivalent of the Force Research Unit, and they're trying to tip things in a certain direction. I'm sure those kind of manipulations still go on, because they certainly went on in the past. As Nuro Lone, the police ombudsman, was pointed out on Panorama, BBC investigation by Donald McIntyre some months ago, we now have evidence that hundreds of people were killed by the British Army's Force Research Unit at one remove. So they were running both loyalist and Republican paramilitaries. I don't think they were running all of the paramilitaries, certainly not on the Republican side, but the Republicans were heavily infiltrated, so that, for example, they jarked the bomb so that it goes off killing civilians rather than killing the real target of the bomb, of that bomb at the Shankill Road, which was the UDA leadership.
And what I think this is the Associated Press still is saying, it starts by saying Associated Press, but it's in the Mail Online, so difficult to tell who's writing this, but for decades it says IRA factions have used bombs attached to a vehicle's undercarriage to target politicians, judges and off-duty police. Certainly that was taking place during the Troubles. They also say Easter is a focal point for Irish Republican militancy, dating to 1916, where 1,500 rebels seized the key Dublin buildings in a bid to overthrow British rule. The Easter Rising, though militarily futile, inspired the 1919-21 war with Britain that won independence for the predominantly Catholic south of Ireland, but kept the fledgling state of Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom. The Republic of Ireland government plans major public commemorations and cultural events in Dublin for the 100th anniversary later this month, when the government leaders don the traditional symbol of Irish rebellion on their lapels, the Easter Lily.
Indeed, and the difference, the nickname of the provisionals the nickname of the official IRA was the Stickies, because their labels were, they had a sticky label of a lily, whereas provisional IRA Sinn Féin supporters usually have a metal badge. Which is a metal badge. Lily.
Explain what the difference between these badges is, please.
Well, it's just to do with the history and culture of the Irish Republican movement. The official IRA, which went on ceasefire long before the provisional IRA, their nickname was the Stickies, because they had a sticky badge. At Easter, they put a sticky badge on their lapel. The Provos used to have, and still do, a metal badge. It's like which you put on your lapel. Well, it just shows what side you're on. You're either a Sticky or a Provo. So that's what that's about.
Do you think that there is a possibility that things might flare up again around this political commemoration?
I think this is ongoing. This is never going to end. There's going to be an element of people unhappy with the current setup. But they've got no real political support. And I think the success of Sinn Féin in the recent Irish elections leads me to feel reasonably hopeful.
Who benefited from the Troubles?
Well, nobody, which is why everybody in the end decided to kick to knock it on the head.
Who would want them to start up again?
Well, the Continuity IRA, I don't agree with their politics, but they want to start the Troubles up again because they think that the Republican cause has been sold out. I think they're misguided. They don't. They think that that somehow they're in the right and that Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness have sold them out. I think that's wrong, but there you go. You can't please everybody.
Okay, let's have a look at Omar then. On Tuesday, the case against the only remaining suspect charged with the Omar bombing, in which 29 people were killed, has collapsed, prompting families of the victims to claim their loved ones will never get justice. Northern Ireland's Public Prosecution Service dropped 29 murder charges against Seamus Daly in relation to the single biggest act of mass murder of the Ulster Troubles. A PPS lawyer officially withdrew the prosecution during routine magistrates' court hearing at Ballymena Courthouse in County Antrim Tuesday morning. One of the 29 victims of the bombing was a pregnant woman whose twins were almost full term when she died after a £500 bomb exploded in the centre of the town on a busy Saturday. As well as facing 29 murder charges, Daly had been accused of causing the explosion in the County Tyrone market town in August 1998 and possessing the bomb. This was around about the time of the Good Friday Agreement, wasn't it? Was it just after?
Yeah. So basically, it was an attempt by whoever, ostensibly the Continuity IRA, real IRA, to destabilise the agreement. But the operation had been infiltrated by the intelligence services. So you could argue that they let it happen on purpose. LIHOP, as we call it in the trade. And, of course, there's MIHOP made it happen on purpose and let it happen on purpose. So what you've got to remember is when you're analysing terrorist attacks, you can't always presume that the first explanation of what's happening is the only explanation. There is all sorts of manipulation going on behind the scenes, as has been proved, for example, in this Panorama documentary, which I mentioned earlier.
Families of the victims of Omar have been demanding all this time, an independent inquiry, and they've said an all-Ireland independent inquiry into the events leading up to the bomb, which is what they've been demanding for years. And also, I can remember I was saying this a couple of weeks ago, wasn't I, listening to this in 1998 and hearing a lot of live coverage, I think it was on 5 Live, the reporter saying that the people in the street were complaining on the day that they had been being ushered towards the bomb by the Northern Ireland police.
Yes, in other words, the suspicion is, the suspicion is that they allowed the bomb to go off in order to discredit the Continuity IRA, but the ordinary people of Omar were basically sacrificed in order to achieve that goal. And certainly in the Dublin and Monaghan bombs in 1972, the Garda Síochána are pretty much convinced that Henry Barron, the head of the Irish Supreme Court, produced a report, the Barron report, on those bombs. They are pretty much convinced that the Glenane gang, who have never been prosecuted, loyalist terrorists based in County Antrim, were working with MI5, MI6, who actually gave them the explosives and gave them the training to carry out those simultaneous bombs both in Dublin and Monaghan. Now, in other words, this is a very dirty can of worms, as you might imagine.
Another story relating to Northern Irish terrorism this week. Dissident Republicans vow to wipe out all known drug dealers after the death of the brother of the real IRA commander. This is in the Daily Mirror by David Maher. Vincent Vinnie Ryan, who became a dad for the first time last month, was shot dead as he sat in his car outside his girlfriend's home on Monday.
Well, the Republican dissidents are trying to rebuild support in the community in Dublin and in Belfast and in other cities in Ireland like Limerick by carrying out vigilante actions against drug dealers because they think it's going to give them some kind of popular credibility. And at one stage, for example, you know, back in the day, the Republican movement did in fact police the community pretty ruthlessly. So they're just trying to repeat the strategy. But as the leaders of the mainstream Republican movement made absolutely clear, there is no place for vigilantism in modern Ireland, and that everything should be left to independent police investigation. And I say independent police investigation with advice, because we're not talking about giving the security services and people like the security services a free run. The police service of Northern Ireland is mandated to try and catch the security services if they are involved in terrorism. That's what the deal says.
Also, Martin, this week we've heard of imposition of sanctions on North Korea, and yet not on on Saudi Arabia, despite a vote in the European Parliament to stop all arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Apparently BAE Systems and other British arms companies are doing very well out of the bombarding of Yemen by the Saudis.
Well, there's also a spokesperson for the Saudis spoke on Russia Today this week, saying they've already got nuclear weapons from the Pakistanis. So are we going to threaten the Saudis with sanctions? I don't think so, because basically they're our allies. They're our allies in Syria. That's the home of jihadi Wahhabi terrorism. It has been since the 1980s. And guess what? British military personnel have been working with them all along and still are. That's why the Irish look at the British when they go, oh, we're against jihadi terrorism. So, well, you've not been against jihadi terrorism in 30 or 40 years. You've been working very closely with these people for years. And I think the Syrian crisis has really brought it home. It's not just something that happened in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. It's going on now under David Cameron.
But Saudi Arabia has not conducted a nuclear test. North Korea has.
Well, there are interesting questions about where North Korea got its nuclear weapons from. And I have inside information, which is not necessarily to be... I can't say who I got it from, and it's only gossip, that those bombs were, in fact, South Africa's nuclear bombs, which were passed to the North Koreans by a guy called John Bredenkamp and another fellow called Billy Reutenbach, who are based in Kilmersdown in Somerset, and are ex-Rhodesian SAS operatives. And they were working with Stephen Koch, an ex-MI6 agent, to illegally sell South Africa's nuclear weapons, allegedly, to the North Koreans. Now, I don't know whether that's true, but that's the information I'm being given.
It's also, I mean, it's worth remembering, isn't it, that back in about 1999, I think it was, maybe 98, on Roger Cook's programme, The Cook Report, which was on ITV, of course, he did it for many people will remember that he did a programme, really, in a way, predicting the 9/11 attacks by showing how easy it was to smuggle things onto weapons, onto aircraft, really just in a journalistic sting operation at Boston Airport. But this one particular programme, he was looking at the former Soviet Union and how easy it was to get hold of weapons from soldiers who were guarding bases in the former Soviet Union that hadn't been paid. And as part of that programme, he was offered, first of all, weapons-grade plutonium to build a nuclear weapon with. And then secondly, after that, the next meeting he had with these arms dealers, they said, well, we do have an SS-20 missile, which carries, I think it's two or three hydrogen bombs. And if you know how to use the thing, you can point it pretty much anywhere within 3,000 miles.
Well, this was the Yeltsin era in Russia, where Western advisors allowed the economy to crash through the floor, and lots of and the military of the Soviet Union to disintegrate. Modern Russia has a democratic government, whatever the West says. Putin has massive popular support, and it also has a very competent professional military operation. I don't think you get the same chance to buy off the peg weaponry now that you had in that era, and that's all to the good, and that's because the Russians have got their act together. And of course the Russian general staff have repeated what I've been saying on this show in the first hour and the second hour, that all the evidence shows that NATO intelligence services working with the Gulf Cooperation Council states are the supporters of jihadi terrorism in Syria and elsewhere. They always have been.
Subject of Syria came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week with a question, I'm not quite sure who it's by, but anyway, we'll hear that now to the Prime Minister, David Cameron.
Liz Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Syrian ceasefire is extremely fragile. There are reports that Russia is continuing to attack anti-Assad rebels, not Daesh, and that Islamic terrorists and weapons continue to pass into Syria across the Turkish border. What is the British government doing to ensure the ceasefire is properly monitored, and in particular to reduce serious tensions between Russia and our NATO ally, Turkey?
Yeah. Well, the Honourable Lady is absolutely right to raise this. The cessation of hostilities is an important step forward, imperfect though it is, and it does enable the possibility of political negotiations starting next week. She asked specifically, what are we trying to do to make sure it's properly enforced? We're working with the Americans and the Russians to make that happen. I've got a European conference call with Vladimir Putin later this week. week to reinforce these points. Even though the ceasefire is imperfect, it is progress that we have it. Not every group is included in the ceasefire, but basically there aren't the attacks that were taking place on the moderate opposition, which is welcome. And it's also enabled us with others to get aid into communities that desperately need it, including through airdrops and convoys. So I wouldn't put too much optimism into the mix right now, but this is progress and we should work on it.
Well, when he talks about the moderate rebels, this is absolutely disingenuous. The moderate rebels are the al-Nusra Front, who are actually al-Qaeda Syria. And they've been working very closely with our Turkish military allies in NATO, and they have been working very closely with our military to make sure that they try to overthrow the what is, in fact, the elected government of Syria.
Well, hang on, Martin. You're going from one organisation to another, to another, to another, saying they're all the same.
No, they're not all the same. This week, in fact, what the Russians have done, which is rather clever, they have signed ceasefire agreements with 44 different small groups. And what they're trying to do is get people into a peace process, so their intervention in Syria has been to get a peace process going. They've been saying, look, Assad isn't going to go, but you can do a deal with Assad without mediation, and we can bring this thing to an end without killing everybody. But we're not going to stop bombing Daesh, and we're not going to stop bombing al-Nusra, even though both organisations are definitely being supported by the Turks, who are part of NATO, funded by your taxes. And the Saudi Arabians are also talking about intervening in Syria. They are our allies. That is the home of Wahhabi jihadi terrorism, and they have British military officers in Riyadh at the moment helping the Saudis with British military equipment, which we've sold them, to kill people in Yemen, thousands of civilians. That is terrorism. And when David Cameron accuses Jeremy Corbyn of being a sympathiser of terrorism, David Cameron isn't a sympathiser of terrorism. He is a terrorist because he supports these so-called moderate rebels. That's a complete mealy-mouthed load of nonsense. There are no moderate rebels. Does he mean the moderate rebels of the Continuity IRA? No, he doesn't. He means al-Nusra Front.
They are Assad's political opposition.
They are they're Assad's armed political opposition. Now, if I take up arms against the British government, Assad won a democratic election in Syria 2 years ago. It wasn't a very satisfactory election in many ways. Many people who didn't want him to win didn't participate. It's the same sort of thing that happened in Egypt, where the military government had an election in which 30% of the people participated and the Muslim Brotherhood were banned. But are we allowing British military personnel to help train the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt to fight the Egyptian army? No. We're supplying weapons to the Egyptian army. We have good relations with the Egyptian army. We've tried to overthrow the government of Syria over the last 4 years. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, has been on the TV in France, and he said, while I was a foreign minister, before the Arab Spring, before all of this kicked off, I was approached by British officials, we can read MI6, they said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? Now, in other words, Britain in particular is accused by the Syrian government, by the Russian general staff, and by the Iranian general staff of being major players in the carnage in Syria. And you know what? They're right. We are. And of course, what goes around comes around.
What about these beheading videos? Because I noticed an interesting article in the Daily Mail, I think it is. Does ISIS really have 7-foot-tall executioners? Parts of a grisly film showing the beheading of 21 Christians were faked, claim experts. ISIS released a video showing the murder of 21 Coptic Christians. The 5-minute film showed the men being marched along a beach. The victims are then shown lined up and beheaded in sequence. Experts believe the Egyptian victims were not murdered at the beach. Instead, they were murdered elsewhere with the background added later. A shocking scene of the sea turning red is special effects. The scene where the sea turns red with blood is also thought to be faked. It's believed apparently the actual murders were filmed in a different location and the sea was added in at a later stage. There are also doubts as to whether the men were all murdered on the beach and whether they were all killed at the same time. Thought sections of the footage may have been shot on a green screen in a studio, a technique used in Hollywood at blockbusters, and that the beach background was added at a later stage. Experts also claim the ISIS jihadi sounds like an American.
Well, in actual fact, all of these beheading videos and various other videos in which we've been subjected to, which clearly are fakes, because experts have had a look at them and said, look, this is a fake video. Do you know what the source for these videos? It's actually a website called Site. searching the internet for terrorist entities. And it's run by an ex-Israeli intelligence agent called Rita Katz, who lives in Langley, Virginia, just down the road from the CIA. And they, for some reason, ISIS put all their videos out through her. She looks around the internet and finds the ISIS videos. They haven't got their own website. It's her website, which is the source of all of these propaganda videos. And of course, the Russian general staff have drawn their own conclusions. The jihadis in Syria are being armed, trained and directed by Western intelligence services and the Israelis and the Saudis. And of course, a lot of this stuff is actually psychological warfare propaganda and not actually videos of anything at all. And of course, they've got a track record of doing exactly this sort of thing in Afghanistan in the 1980s. The Mujahideen, remember them? The founding fathers, the freedom fighters, they funded all of their activities with heroin supplied onto the streets of Bristol. And it was all done with the connivance of MI6, our intelligence services. Now, when I say these things, I understand why we've got to have intelligence services in the very dangerous world that we live in, but the problem is our intelligence services are part of the problem and not part of the solution. So we've got to get an intelligence service that is part of the solution and not part of the problem. Well, and that means heads will have to roll.
Libya is in absolute meltdown, of course, since the overthrow of Gaddafi. Troops trickle in, we hear this week, as West prepares for a Libya war. Italy is insisting the war is on hold until a unity government has been formed. But last week, a major French newspaper, Le Monde, reported that the French government is engaged in a secret war in Libya and has deployed special forces already. The Pentagon has also talked about its own presence in Libya, and Britain is understood to have some special forces there as well. Not surprising, is it? We heard the announcement of the doubling of the SAS, Martin, and loads more MI6 agents being recruited at the Mansion House speech David Cameron gave.
Well, what they were doing, the Benghazi incident, which is causing such problems for Hillary Clinton in the election in the US, what clearly was going on there is they were getting weaponry from Libyan stockpiles and shipping it to Syria to support their protégés inside Syria. And Abdul Hakim Belhaj, who was the head of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and incidentally is suing the British government for torturing him, but he was actually a British agent, he then was infiltrated into Syria and became the head of the Free Syrian Army, even though he's a Libyan from Benghazi. So the Free Syrian Army, most of the jihadis fighting inside Syria aren't even Syrians. They are people recruited all over the Middle East, particularly from Libya, by intelligence agencies of the West and the Saudis in order to overthrow Assad. I don't think anybody serious disputes that that's what's been going on.
Well, you mentioned Hillary Clinton there, but certainly these revelations about her corrupt behaviour and, in fact, one might say terrorist behaviour, don't seem to be doing her any damage, because she seems to be the front runner for the Democrats in the US against Donald Trump, who's the front runner for the Republicans. And we had quite an interesting exchange this week on the television over in the US, the Bill Maher show, and he had this general called Michael Hayden on talking about Donald Trump. Let's have a listen to that now.
I would be incredibly concerned if a President Trump governed in a way that was consistent with the language that candidate Trump expressed during the campaign.
What language? Like what?
We're going to do waterboarding and a whole lot more because they deserve it. We did.
What about killing the terrorist families?
Families. Let me give you a punchline. All right. If he were to order that once in government, the American Armed Forces would refuse to act.
Oh, well, that's quite a statement, sir.
I thought the whole thing was you have to follow orders. You cannot. You're not committed. You're not required. In fact, you're required not to follow an unlawful order. That would be in violation of all the international laws of armed conflict.
Wow. So, all right. Well.
Well, I'm not quite clear what it is Donald Trump is supposed to be ordering that they wouldn't do.
Oh, well, okay. At the beginning of that, what he said was that he wanted not just terrorists to be killed, but all their families to be killed as well. And he was also talking about what a wonderful thing waterboarding was.
Well, the fact of the matter is that is illegal. And it doesn't matter how many elections you win, like Berlusconi in Italy, if you are a criminal, you are a criminal. And that's why we have, that's why the founding fathers of the United States created a separation of powers. And in theory, the judiciary is independent of elected officials, because if elected officials are carrying out criminal activities, including murder, etc., then the judiciary is supposed to chase after them and arrest them. Now, in actual fact, we all know that that very rarely happens. But I think we're coming very close to the edge here now. There has been a criminal conspiracy at the heart of the Western intelligence services for many, many years now. Trump is just speaking out loud what they've been doing in private anyway. We've all heard of Guantanamo Bay, but in actual fact there are hundreds of black sites all over the world where people are being tortured without habeas corpus by us, by our forces. That is illegal. And Brigadier Gordon Kerr used to run the France Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland. The finger was pointed at him by Sir John Stevens of the Metropolitan Police. You are a terrorist. If you're engaged in that sort of activity, including arming and training jihadi groups, which they have been, you are the terrorist. And the answer to that is not to fight you, it's to arrest you and put you in prison.
Are you trying to tell us the Chinese and the Russians are not terrorists either?
Well, everybody, there's got to be a rule of law.
Aren't all these big major powers gangsters?
Yes, they are, but there's going to be a rule of law, otherwise that's what the United Nations Charter says. There's going to be a rule of law. If people in Russia have been involved in false flag terrorism,
the UN are imposing their rule of law on North Korea, aren't they?
Well, the North Korean issue is a separate one. It's a geopolitical contest there. The North Koreans are, I've got no brief for defending them. But the fact of the matter is that all of these activities, including arming and training jihadi terrorists, we're supposed to be having a war against Al-Qaeda at the same time we're training them. That can't be accepted. It's not going to be accepted. Ultimately, the civilian police force in Italy, Ireland and Britain must do their duty, as Sir John Stevens did with the head of the
British Army's Force Research. But they're not being trained here in the woods down the road, are they?
Sorry?
They're not being trained here in Britain.
Do you know that?
Well, I would imagine.
The SAS
certainly.
Look,
if I was going to train them, I would send out people to train them abroad in places like Jordan.
The fact of the matter is, Jordan or Turkey. Well, they've certainly been training them in Jordan and Turkey, but we know in the 1980s that Afghans were taken to Scotland and trained by the SAS in how to shoot down aircraft, particularly airliners, with ground-to-air missiles. We know. That's a fact. It happened years ago. It's just a factually established thing. And everybody knows that that's what happened. They are supplying ground-to-air missiles now to their protégés inside Syria in the hopes of trying to bring down the Russian aircraft which are bombing them back to the Stone Age. This is a war. Of course it is, but it's also a criminal activity.
Well, it's nothing new, is it? Because I was rereading, in fact, something from December from the Sputniknews.com website, a Russian site, about the post-World War II world order. US plan to wipe Russia out, the USSR out, by a massive nuclear strike. Was the US deterrence military doctrine aimed against the Soviet Union during the Cold War era really defensive? Who actually started the nuclear arms race? Just weeks after the Second World War was over and Nazi Germany defeated, Soviet Russia's allies, the US and Great Britain, hastened to develop military plans aimed at dismantling the USSR and wiping out its cities with a massive nuclear strike. Interestingly enough, then British Prime Minister Winston Churchill ordered the British Armed Forces Joint Planning Staff to develop a strategy targeting the USSR months before the end of the Second World War. First edition of the plan was prepared on the 22nd of May 1945. In accordance with the plan, the invasion of Russia, Russian-held Europe by the Allies, was scheduled to begin on the 1st of July 1945. Now, I know Patton was sacked, I think, was it by Truman, for suggesting this, but actually the plans were there, that the armies that were the American army in Europe was going to join with other allies and attack the Soviet army on the 1st of July 1945, and with nuclear, possibly anyway, after weapons have been developed, with nuclear backup.
Yes, well, isn't it interesting?
Winston Churchill called it Operation Unthinkable.
Indeed. And, of course, what was also going on at the time was a backhanded, under-the-counter deal with the German intelligence operation in Eastern Europe, led the Gestapo, etc. So Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head the Gestapo, and I sent you an email about another senior military commander of the
Wehrmacht. You're talking about Adolf Heusinger, yeah. Adolf Hitler's chief of the general staff of the army during World War II, went on to become the chairman of NATO's military committee from 1961 to 1964. So he wasn't just hanging around, he was the chair of NATO's military committee for 3 years. This is Adolf Hitler's chief of the general staff from World War II.
Well, I would argue that the whole Gladio network in Western Europe, which was part of the terrorist strategy of tension in the 70s, 80s and 90s, was basically run by fascist intelligence operatives working with MI6, CIA and other similar groups. And that the techniques of psychological warfare which they're using, so terrorist attacks which are being manipulated from inside the intelligence services, have all the hallmarks of standard fascist psychological warfare technique. But of course, it's much more subtle and more sophisticated than the Nazis themselves developed in Germany in the 30s. And they were allies in trying to smash the Soviet Union. Whatever you may think of the Soviet
it's
Union,
interesting.
That's what they were doing.
One of the types of organisation I find fascinating to look at, I suppose you could even call them an NGO, is a club of retired, in inverted commas, intelligence officers called the Club de Bern, which is based in Bern in Switzerland. So that is where a lot of ex-intelligence people get together. And also, it's a very informal way of linking up in a supposed neutral country intelligence officers from all over the Western world.
Well, Daniela Ganser, who is a Swiss academic, has written the definitive book on this, NATO's Secret Armies. And, of course, that nothing has changed. They are still fomenting Islamist, fascist and potentially left-wing terrorism. For example, we're talking about the Continuity IRA earlier. Perhaps we could call them left-wing terrorists. And the whole point of manipulating terrorism is to control the population to achieve certain political goals. I was just reading a book recently about the gunpowder plot. And did you know that Guy Fawkes never existed? It was a guy called John Johnson, who was a Catholic activist and an explosives expert, and he was tortured into naming himself Guido Fawkes because that sounded suitably foreign and malevolent. And the most recent research on the bulk gunpowder plot now points the finger firmly at the British government for setting up the plot in order to make the Catholics look bad, etc. This stuff has a long history.
Also, Martin, one of the things that we're doing week after week is in analysing this stuff. There are big organisations that make lots of money out of doing what we do for free here every week, and one of them is Stratfor. Stratfor is, though I know it's not one of your favourite organisations to get analysis from, so although people might be paying and the governments and big businesses may be paying lots of money to Stratfor, they're not necessarily getting the true dope, are they?
No, I mean, it's basically a private sector CIA, is what some people have called it. But Akerlof, who founded Stratfor, was absolutely clear, for example, that the coup in Ukraine was a coup. He said it's the most obvious coup that we've ever seen. So I do occasionally read their stuff because it's on another level from the sort of stuff that we heard from our former MP earlier, who clearly doesn't do any research about this at all and is just worried about Islamists under the bed and actually doesn't understand the geopolitics. That's what.
Well, I mean, that's not fair, is it? Because he's not here to reply to you, Martin. But what I'm trying to say is that there are that Stratfor is not the only one of these analysis and intelligence groups. There's this as another one which has started up recently called South Front. What they say they do is highlighting alternative points of view, providing independent analysis and intelligence of international events, breaking through the information blockade and media bias, promoting human justice and peaceful dialogue between warring nations, preventing the escalation of conflicts that can lead to wars, the threat of use of nuclear weapons, and reducing the flow. I mean, they've mentioned it again. They obviously think media disinformation is a major weapon of war.
Of course it is. We're basically being lied to consistently. The purpose of carrying out these attacks and then lying about them afterwards
but you can't,
is to achieve
surely,
certain goals.
You can't lie simultaneously on all channels. Well, or all newspapers.
Well, no, you can. Most people haven't got the time, the inclination, or the energy to research all of this. Although what the internet is doing, and this is what South Front are saying, is it's now allowing non-traditional people who have got the necessary intellectual skills to analyse what's going on using open source information. And there's clearly the case. I mean, I get all my information about all these things from the internet. So the internet's full of misinformation. No, I mean, the point about getting information from the internet, you've got to be able to assess it. It's not just a question
actually,
of
one of the things,
reading it.
One,
so
of, the things,
on the
one
internet.
Of the things they do is they do that for you in a way. And I mean, just to plug their website, which is www.southfront.org, they come up with regular updates of things that which we just simply do not hear about in the news. For example, last week they were talking about 30 Saudi Air Force officers with a cargo of military equipment arriving at the Intelik military air base in Turkey to prepare for a joint campaign in Syria. Deployment of Saudi fighter jets is expected within the next 24 hours. So they're saying effectively that Saudis are now sitting there at NATO air bases in Turkey ready to attack Syria.
Yes, and also from that airbase, the Turks are bombing inside Iraq PKK forces who they've got a civil war with. Why are the PKK terrorists, but the moderate rebels in Syria are allies? And the answer is that there isn't an answer. We are basically terrorists. We are terrorists. Many Kurds in Turkey would see NATO as a terrorist organisation, because it is. And the bombings in Turkey, like the bombing of one of their rallies, which killed 30-some-odd of their people at Suruk, they're all pretty convinced that that was carried out by MIT, which is the Turkish military intelligence operation. And as I said earlier, the Turkish police have arrested MIT people taking weaponry into Turkey to give to the militants. And they themselves have now been put on trial for treason for pointing this out.
So what's the difference then between, would you say in your words, between Southfront.org and Stratfor?
Southfront.org is people like us getting together to try and find out what's going on without a financial incentive. Stratfor is a business closely linked to the CIA, and they employ plenty of ex-CIA people there. That's where they go when they finish their nefarious activities in the public sector. They're then transferred to Stratfor to make a bit of money.
I would say it in a rather shorter way, and that's psychological warfare is the difference between one and the other. I spoke earlier this week on our dialect show, which will be back on BCFM noon on Tuesdays very soon, but you can get it online at www.dialectradio.co.uk. and this week I spoke to Jay Dyer over in the US, who's written quite a lot about this thing called predictive programming. Before we go into the interview, Martin, do you want to just pray see what you understand by predictive programming?
Well, the suggestion is that when you're planning things, say the 9/11 attack, you, for several years before the attack, because it obviously had a long time horizon for planning, it probably began in the Northwoods planning in 1964, which we now have the evidence about that, again through foreign freedom of information requests and so
yes,
on.
Yes, I mean, if you want to find that online, just look up Operation Northwoods.
Yeah, but the General Staff, Lyman Lemnitzer, and the US General Staff were planning to bomb civilian targets inside the US and kidnap airliners in order to blame it on the Cubans, and that was a plan that they had. We've got the documents. That's what they were planning to do. It was knocked back by Kennedy, but Kennedy didn't survive much longer after he'd knocked it back. So I would suggest that something like the 9/11 attack was probably on the drawing board in the early 1960s and gradually brought to fruition. Now, in other words, what you then need to do is you need to suggest to the population that there is a possibility that planes will be hijacked and crashed into buildings. So on the day of the attack, Condoleezza Rice said, who could have known that they would hijack planes and crash them into buildings? Well, only the military and intelligence services of the US, who are actually carrying out several exercises on the day of exactly that scenario of planes being hijacked and crashed into buildings. But of course, what you're doing, it's suggestion. So when the planes are supposedly hijacked and crashed into buildings, you've already prepared the ground for people to believe that it was indeed Bin Laden, etc. So the attack on the World Trade Center in 1996, the FBI were all over that case. They were the perpetrators. But of course, what you've done is you've planted the seed in the mind. Oh yes, these Islamists are going to attack the World Trade Center, but it was an FBI plot. The Islamists were all actually working with the FBI.
Sounds like this is less news being reported on in a genuine manner, a more theatre.
Indeed, and that's but the point about the internet and shows like this is that But with simple searches, we can actually expose it all. And that's what South Front are doing. They've got very good people, many of them ex-intelligence and police officers, and they're doing their job of telling us what the hell's going on.
And doing the job of untangling psychological warfare and predictive programming in the US, amongst other things, is Jay Dyer at jaysanalysis.com. And I spoke to him, as I said, earlier this week on the dialectradio.co.uk on that podcast.
Hollywood, mass media, they're all kind of arms of the same octopus, and they are psychological warfare. That's what they... I mean, they have other functions as well, you know, obviously monetary gain and promoting the careers of whoever, whatever, CEOs and so forth. But the primary goal, I think, is, and the reason we know this is that you see a unified agenda across the presentation of most films, especially. And so you do, for example, Independence Day, there's a documentary, Real Bad Arabs, this all throughout the 90s up into the early 2000s, you had the presentation of the Arab villain as the essentially the only villain that's out there in the world. And this was, you know, building up to 9/11. Another film like Starship Troopers is treated in Professor Gaines' piece as tying into the writings of Brzezinski. So the Grand Chessboard came out a few years after Starship Troopers. And again, what do we have? Yes, it's dealing with aliens. And I'm not, you know, the aliens are not the problem. The problem is the creation of the unconscious association of the external threat, right? And that's the point of how fiction can be used in psychological warfare. And this goes all the way back to The Twilight Zone. You can see the early episodes of The Twilight Zone in the credits. They'll talk about how they were created in consultation with the Department of Defense. And a lot of those Twilight Zone episodes dealt with specifically World War II and then Cold War propaganda. So the idea was, oh, the Soviet threats, you know, it's everywhere. Then that transitions into the War on Terror. You know, the external alien threat is just everywhere. They're going to get you. And so you're absolutely right that we're the target. And it goes much deeper than that and darker than that, unfortunately. We think about Michael Aquino, who's a psychological warfare expert in the Army. He's one of the highest specialists in the Army in regard to this, and he wrote a famous piece called Mind War and Psy War, From Mind War to Psy War, right, which deals with how the U.S. needs to transition out of psychological warfare into actually controlling the perception of the populace. Not just targeting the populace for certain buildups to a war and, you know, maybe getting everyone on board, but actually a full spectrum controlling of perception, not just perception of war or politics, but of the entirety of one's worldview, of reality itself. So it's a very wide-ranging in scope, and it's subversive, and it is targeted at the population as a whole.
Sounds almost like paranoia, doesn't it, to think that when you're sitting down relaxing in your comfortable cinema seat that you're being programmed, or that there's some kind of hidden agenda behind what you're watching?
Well, it's not even that hidden, is it? I mean, often people snigger, British people, when they're watching US films, because the baddies are so transparently baddie and the goodies are so transparently good that nuance is missing. It's not, you know, and you've got to suspend disbelief completely. It's like watching a James Bond film. How real is this?
No, one of the things I can remember from the 1980s is the contrast between the Star Trek series in the States, where the Federation, who was controlling everything, were the good guys, to Blake 7, which was a science fiction series here in Britain, set in a similar kind of, you know, out in the universe, where the Federation were the evil guys, in a way, that's a difference in attitude, I think, between British traditional drama and US drama, at least back in the last century, anyway.
Indeed. And I think what people, I mean, you do get some good films which are made which expose the way in which,
well, there's the big short for example at the moment in cinemas, which is a really good attempt to dramatize some of the hypocrisy around the whole 2008 financial crisis. And I think maybe we only touched on it briefly, Martin, but Mervyn King's statement that there will be another crash because there's been no reforms of the banking system from King Mervyn, as I used to call him, is really apposite this week. week. Also pointing out, of course, that the person he's pointing the finger at, essentially, is Mark Carney, because Mark Carney is in charge at the Bank for International Settlements of international banking regulation.
Well, he's not. He's the governor of the Bank of England.
He was. When they swapped over, I mean, I don't know. I imagine he's still got a role, a very important role at the Bank for International Settlements. There, yeah.
Well, William White, who is the chief economist of the Bank of International Settlements, has said there's going to be another crash. Even George Osborne has started to hint that there's going to be another crash. Of course there's going to be another crash. What else is going to happen?
I think we've got to just expand it. I mean, I've done it myself there, bubble, but which is saying crash. Talking about a 2008 crash is actually not accurate. As a 2008, there was a threatened crash and a bailout.
Well, why they call it a crash is because there was a significant drop in gross domestic product across the world, which led to a spike in unemployment and all the rest of it. But because they bailed the banks out, the banks are still there and still extracting their pound of flesh from the rest of us. What they should have done, having bailed them out, in my view, is you then have an orderly bankruptcy procedure. That's what should have happened to Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank is exposed to Greece. They lent Greece too much money. So what you do is you bankrupt not Greece, you bankrupt Deutsche Bank, but you do it in an orderly fashion. Because if you don't do it in an orderly fashion, it's going to happen in a disorderly
fashion.
The
EU,
and that's what's going to happen now.
The EU were absolutely in on the scam, because I was watching the documentary The Brussels Business with Olivia Herdman, I think he is, from Corporate Europe Observatory, discussing how the EU reacted to the 2008 crisis.
1 month after the financial crisis started in October 2008, José Manuel Barroso appointed the independent high-level group on financial supervision. The group was to work out proposals for the regulation of the financial markets and to find a way out of the financial crisis. 8 so-called wise men were appointed to this group. Jacques de La Roche, Rainer Massera, Onno Ruding, Otmar Ising, Callum McCarthy, Leszek Balcerowicz, José Pérez Fernández and Lars Nuber. We looked into the independence of this independent group and we found some astonishing things. De La Roche is the co-chair of a financial lobby organization. Massera is linked to Lehman Brothers, Ruding to Citigroup, Ising to Goldman Sachs. McCarthy, Nuber and Balcerowicz are notorious deregulators. And Pérez Fernández works to provide financial market intelligence to big banks. 3 of the 8 were directly linked to American banks, all of which were directly involved in causing the crisis. Balcerowicz, in addition, is closely linked to American right-wing think tanks like the Cato Institute, which was one of the closest advisors to the Bush administration. He was also involved in neoliberal think tanks in Brussels and Poland and the UK. Not a single of these wise men was in favor of strict regulation. Not a single one of them was really independent. And the effect of these 8 wise men on overcoming the financial crisis was zero. The main thing that happened was that a lot of public money was flowing to the banks.
The same financial institutions that were bailed out with taxpayers' money are now making a fortune from Greece's misfortune.
After 20 years of deregulation and liberalization, suddenly the European Union herself was at the edge of being blown up. What is at stake is not only the European Union, but also democracy and the future of the values that we hold dear.
Well, the fundamental problem we face is the insolvency of the banking system. So we're going to have a EU referendum in this country, which is essentially discussing rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Now, it's quite possible that before June the 23rd, Deutsche Bank will collapse. And that means, folks out there, you are going to lose your savings. And that's far more important than whether we are in or out of the EU on paper.
So does it mean that's better if you haven't got any money, you're in debt or something?
No, those who've got money will lose it, those without money will lose everything. And of course the consequences of that will be things like civil war. In Greece, of course, they were the most resistant to the German occupation during the Second World War. Hundreds of thousands of people died under torture, waterboarding and all the rest of it. They remember.
OK, and our final item tonight, the 1933 transfer agreement between the Zionist movement and Hitler, which ended the Jewish boycott on the Nazi regime. Edwin Black, Jewish, wrote a book about this, a little known but very dodgy deal.
Dr. Stephen S. Wise, rabbi of the Free Synagogue and the national leader of liberal thought, speaks in behalf of the Jews of the United States.
This is not a Jewish meeting. This is the conscience of America making itself felt.
The conscience of Nazi Germany made itself felt 5 days later. Across the Reich, Hitler's troops shut down Jewish-owned businesses for 24 hours. Within days, American Jews marched calling for the boycott of all German exports. Jews throughout Europe echoed that call. So did Jews everywhere. But a group of Zionists at the same time was quietly negotiating an agreement with the Nazis to allow the immigration of German Jews and the transfer of their assets to Palestine. That deal, reported in August 1933, was the transfer agreement. Palestine, sparsely settled by Jews at the time, was radically changed as a result.
I lived in Palestine from 1933 to 1936, and we saw every week transports of German Jews coming to settle in Palestine. And many new professions were introduced by them into the country, and they played a leading role in making Palestine then a more advanced and progressive country.
German-Jewish settlement of Palestine was, for a time, official Nazi policy. These photos of Jewish life in Palestine, along with a lengthy text, appeared in 1934 in the Berlin paper Der Angriff. The publisher, Hitler's propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels. A Nazi Visits Palestine was the title of the multi-part series. A medal was struck by Goebbels in commemoration. On one side, the swastika. On the other, the Star of David. Hitler demanded one concession for the transfer agreement, that the call for a boycott of the Reich raised by Jews here and elsewhere be rejected by the Zionists. The Zionists made that concession.
That's the Edwin Black book, The Transfer Agreement, a US news report on it. But Martin, very surprising really to hear that the Zionists actually stopped the boycott of Hitler by the Jews.
Well, I mean, this is actually, again, fairly well known to those who know their history. And, you know, the book, Paul Manning's book,
Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile.
In that book, it's pointed out that Bormann was very keen after the war to make sure that he had plenty of Jews on all of the boards of the companies that he controlled, and that he also helped to train Mossad. So the ex-Nazis helped to train Mossad
also,
in the 1950s.
Also, Martin, worth pointing out, Middle East Eye is a really good source for this kind of thing. An award-winning, this is just this last week, award-winning Israeli filmmaker has called Netanyahu government fascist.
Well, I mean, we can bandy these words around. They're certainly criminal. They're involved in false flag terrorism, much as our intelligence services are. All of them should be behind bars.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next is Mohammed Makawi with the Arabian Nights. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Stephen Williams, former Bristol West MP, and also to Bruce Williamson from Rail Future. Thanks to old Labour Oxford economist, also Martin Summers.